And it's like, okay, there's all this canon, like, adventures and video games about, like, stuff happening in Neverwinter. And then this entire edition, just nothing happens there, right? Like, it's just ghosts or whatever. But,
well, it was Neverwinter Night.
Well, yeah, and that was third edition, right? And then fourth edition comes along and it's like, oh, Neverwinter doesn't matter.
No, it was, like, it was nighttime in Neverwinter. There was just, everyone was...
Right, it was just... still warm, but dark.
Live from the Mundangerous Mountain Pass in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 349 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about how to keep using your campaign setting when it's been solved, or broken, or just gone off the rails. But first, the party shakes on it in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, John Henry hammers it home in the Character Creation Forge. So, Shane, I'm having some flashbacks to our very, very early days of recording back in the Mundangerous Pillow Fort, if you recall.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Those halcyon days.
Yes, right. Oh, so innocent days. Pre any nomination, I might add.
Yeah, back when we were like, oh, we have 12 ideas for episodes. We'll be fine.
Yeah, back when we were like, we should rewrite episode zero because we have 20 episodes. But I am currently in the latest iteration of a pillow type fort. I have not recorded under a sheet next to chairs in quite a while. Although, I mean, you know, kids make it so that you record where you can. Mm-hmm. I think you've done it under a few desks relatively recently. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're in an Airbnb in Italy, and I have made one wall of stroller, one wall of suitcase, and one wall of chair, and I'm huddling under like a Halloween ghost. So here's hoping the audio's okay.
You're coming in great.
Sorry, Aram.
Now, important question for you, and this is going to be relevant in short order, given that it's episode 349. When episode 350 comes around, are you going to have enough room for a beer in there?
Ooh, that's an excellent question. I think...
And what if it's a terrible flavor of beer? What if it's an awful novelty flavor?
Beer is very cheap here. I might have to, like, order a bad flavor online because... The only beer here is, you know, beer that was brewed down here. The street.
Yeah,
exactly. Otherwise, it's like, you know, one, nobody carries it. And two, even if you can find it, the import taxes are ridiculous and absolutely not worth it. But I will definitely see what I can find. What about you? What will your choice be as we do a mailbag for episode 350?
I don't know. I mean, I'm going to go to the corner store and I'm going to find the most disgusting sounding beer or... hard seltzer that I can find. I'm going to look for whichever flavor just sounds least appealing. And I know they're not going to sell me one, so I'm going to have to get a six pack.
We'll start recording right around the 3.5 mark.
Right.
Because, of course, as is tradition for the big numbers, the big round numbers in our, you know, base 10 accounting, we're doing a mailbag next episode for episode 350 of the podcast.
Which means it is a vanishingly small amount of time left to get questions in the mailbag. We've got quite a few so far, but always have room for some more. So if you would like to get them in, you have a bit, like a couple days probably, to get them in as of when this is released.
Yeah, so send them on over to totalpartythrill@gmail.com, at TPTcast on Twitter or X or whatever it's called these days. I hope this comment doesn't age well.
I think its name is actually X, formerly known as Twitter.
Oh, right,
its official name is X, formerly known as Twitter.
It's just X.
Yeah, because no one says X. All I ever see it printed is X, and then in parentheses, formerly Twitter.
The social media network formerly known as Twitter. Ooh, come on the Discord and ask the question there. You'll get answers right away. And then, you know, not better, but different answers from us on the show.
Right. Or just purloined answers from us on the show.
Yes, right. We will file the names off and call it our own.
Exactly.
Like we do with our games.
Right. Speaking of, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And high in the mountains, the party is trying to stop the quarry from finding the Gatekeeper's seals and unleashing the chaos of Zoriat onto the material plane. For the first time, the very first time, the party has encountered a mind seed that has not instantly attacked them. Formerly Voreg the Sellsword, who was killed alongside the party on the Day of Mourning. He is dressed in a loose tunic, just like the other mind seeds they've met, but no halo of psionic energy surrounds his head. He holds up his hands to show he means no harm, and though Vesikad the Kalishtar and Zan want to attack, the others in the party are curious why they haven't been ambushed.
It seems we have a similar goal, Voreg confesses. Neither of us wants the Gate of Earth destroyed. The party knows this to be true. They obviously want to preserve the gates to prevent Zoriat from spilling into Eberron. But the quarry need the gates intact in order to subvert them, to hold Dalkor in place, and prevent the turning of the age. A ruined gate helps no one but the forces of Zoriat. Still wary, the party welcomes an opportunity to catch their breath, so they ask the Sellsword for his story.
Like them, the Mind Seeds figured the best way to reach the other gates first was to blindly teleport. But while the party arrived on the mountainside above, Voreg and his partner arrived underground. Immediately, the other Mind Seed Naleth was corrupted by the trapped Dalkeer, Kirzan, who was much stronger here beneath the surface.
With a powerful scion under his sway, Kirzan now has new means with which to destroy the gate. Voreg barely escaped from the Dalkeer-powered prison before running into the party. He proposes an alliance. They will work together to defeat Naleth and Kirzan, and only then will they try to kill each other.
Vesikad is torn. He can feel that the quarry spirit Cod within him has nothing but hatred for the Mind Seed. But things will be much worse if Dalkor can stall the turning of the age. The party asks Primus telepathically if it can enforce any deal that they make with Voreg.
Both sides are weary of subterfuge and betrayal. They eventually agree to mutually satisfactory terms. They will ally to defeat Naleth and Kirzan. Voreg agrees that Naleth is lost and must die. Neither side can engage in friendly fire, and they may not hold back in the fight in the hopes the other will exhaust their resources. All must make their best effort to win the battle. These terms last until the Gate of Earth is no longer corrupted by Kirzan. Once that occurs, all bets are off with no grace period.
Can you tell we have a lawyer, like a real-life lawyer in the party?
Yeah, for real.
In addition...
It's not like we've gotten screwed over by these contracts from this DM before, so why would we be suspicious?
What? You've only been helped by the letter, if not the spirit, of these contracts.
Oh, is that true?
Probably. I don't recall.
This is a lot.
In addition, once the Gate of Earth is free from Kirzan's influence, the Dreaming Dark may not attempt to subvert it for as long as any member of the party still lives. Voreg laughs at this a little bit because he, of course, does not intend for that to last very long. The quarry, instead, in the meantime, will need to focus their efforts on a different gate.
Voreg also allows Primus to enforce this bargain, though it seems he thinks of Primus as merely some kind of semi-intelligent illusion. When they all speak their agreement, a small golden clasp appears on each of their wrists.
And we'll find out what happens next time.
So this week, we are talking about breaking your campaign setting and somehow putting it back together.
Kind of, sort of, yeah. Like, you know, the immediate aftermath of breaking your campaign setting. So like, what this means is campaign settings, right? Your Forgotten Realms is your Forgotten's Realms, your Eberrons, your Star Wars, Galaxy Far, Far's Away. They're typically static right? Like they exist as a snapshot in time or in the timeline of that campaign setting. Or maybe they reflect a movie or fictional setting that has a set canon that doesn't usually change, right? And it certainly doesn't change in response to an RPG that you are playing in that setting. I mean, this is one of the benefits of playing in a pre-existing setting, right? You don't have to make it all up yourself. It already exists. You can reference a book or a movie or a TV show or whatever and just play with that information for names and locations and, you know, large events in history.
Yeah, so then what happens if we play the game and...
Oh, you mean if you destroy the Death Star early?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, we manage to redirect the laser away from Alderaan.
Sorry, Coruscant. Or what happens if you're playing in, you know, a popular setting and a new sequel, a new book comes out and it changes things that happened? Or, you know, what if there's a new game edition? And, you know, those of us who've been playing RPGs for a while know that pain very acutely. Every single time there's a new Forgotten Realms and everything gets changed. And but you can just wait 10 years and it'll revert. You know, don't worry about it. But what in any of those instances, now the canon of your game doesn't match your reference material. And that's not a problem for the story that you're all telling at the table, but it can be a huge problem for a GM who is trying not to make everything up. It can also be difficult for players who have like this intimate understanding of a campaign setting that they've maybe been playing in for decades. And now it's great that we have affected the world, but now all of my knowledge of this setting, right? The artificial history, the fictional history that I have in my head doesn't apply.
So yeah, what do we do then? Like how do we address this?
You give up. You walk away from the game. You pick something else.
Okay. Well, yeah, game over. That's fine. maybe we'll try a new game in the new canon.
What? Change systems? Why would we? No, we know the system. So like this is relatively easy to deal with on a small scale, right? Small changes, you topple a vizier and replace them. Great. You just, you know, you don't even scrub that part out of your splat book. You just make a note that it's changed in this particular game, right? But many campaigns end with a fundamental change in the setting. You might create a new nation or nations, new gods. That's actually, you know, the epic destiny or the end result of plenty of campaigns is somebody ascends to godhood or some gods die. Some campaigns even introduce like a new paradigm into the world. I think, Tyranny of Dragons. I'm not saying play Tyranny of Dragons, right? But I believe it ends, if you defeat Tiamat, with like greed just being less present in the world. And like, what does the world even look like after that?
Well, I mean, well, it's not a world I would follow to the nine hells. So I don't know that it's like, doesn't look all that different, to be honest.
That's a Forgotten Realms with no 1980s, and I don't want to live there. So what do you do when your game and your PCs have, you know, a good thing has happened? They've been so wildly impactful that the setting doesn't look like what it looks like in your books. You have quite a few options here. And I think the first one, the simplest one, right, is just reboot. Start a new game like the old one didn't happen. I think a lot of us do this with, you know, popular settings like Forgotten Realms. You know, if you are let's take sort of the bog standard platonic ideal of a gaming group, which is we play D&D. We play in the Forgotten Realms. If you have been doing that for years or decades, then probably every time you start a new campaign, you just start over in bog standard Forgotten Realms and nothing in the previous campaign happened because it's essentially an alternate timeline, right? Now right. You are back in Forgotten Realms of the books and not Forgotten Realms of our story.
Right. And if something is different, that becomes like a little Easter egg homage rather than like a meaningful difference.
Right. I think this can be easier at the table or maybe more interesting at the table if you play something else first whether that's you're playing the same system, but you play in a different setting or a different game, you play an entirely different system, right? Like switch DMs, play, you know, play some one shots, play an entire campaign of something else just to sort of like cleanse your palate before you jump right back into the same setting and reset everything in your heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or if you're going to return to the setting, then play it differently, right? Explore like sort of a different subgenre, or, you know, have a different kind of campaign framework, or have different goals and challenges for your characters, right? If you started in, you know, the first campaign was in the Underdark, well then like maybe do an urban or a wilderness campaign, right? If you started in Baldur's Gate, well maybe explore one of the other cities, or like, you know, Chult or something.
Yeah, like, I mean, this goes certainly beyond fantasy, right? Like if you are playing a Star Wars game and you were doing X-Wing dogfighting, like don't do that again, at least not for a while, right? There are plenty of other kinds of games you can play in the same world or the same setting, right? Do like political intrigue on Coruscant, right? Or, right, you know, do moisture farmers get involved with bounty hunters in Jabba, right? You want a different genre, even if you're not in a different place, or you want to have the characters to have very different goals or very different challenges presented to them, so it feels very much like a different game. So you explore different parts of the setting, different aspects of the setting that you didn't necessarily touch on the first time or didn't touch on much.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you know, that could be as simple as like, oh, we were a political intrigue game, dealing with, you know, the houses and the nobility, right, of this place. Now we're going to focus on, you know, the criminal underworld, right? Now we're, you know, we're head knockers in the streets instead of like movers and shakers from the high halls of power.
Yeah. And if this feels like you're basically just sort of like mind tricking yourself into like not being bored with a setting, or like forgetting the stuff that happened before, like that's exactly what you're doing.
That's it. You did it.
we just played a game of pretend, and now we're going to pretend really hard that pretend never pretended.
Exactly.
But you know, maybe you don't want to do that. Maybe you want the things maybe you want the decisions that you made and the challenges that you overcame and the consequences that your characters dealt with to continue to exist, to continue to matter in that setting. That's a little harder, but one of the ways you can do that is to relocate your next game or campaign. And like when I say next game or campaign, right, what I mean is it can be you starting over at like whatever level 1 or 0 XP or whatever. It can also be just a sort of a continuation, like what do these characters do now that the whole world is different, right?
Right, but so it's about... The relocation is about getting to a place that is once again familiar to people who know the canon, mm-hmm. right? And not necessarily like needing to deal with the consequences of the previous campaign's actions, right?
Right, a clean slate, but not completely wiping everything away. What happened before happened. It's just, you know, another book or a different movie. So the previous events or the events of the previous campaign are still canon. They still happened. But now we are playing in a different physical location in the setting that was not affected or was only lightly affected by those events.
Right. Like, you know, it's you're on a different plane. You're on a different planet. You're in a different region, a different city, right? Like they're sure you might hear about the events of the previous campaign, but like fundamentally that stuff isn't necessarily going to change what's true about the setting of your next adventure.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it can be little Easter eggs. It's nice to have a nod to things that came before. But I mean, this is very easy in like a sci-fi setting where you literally go to a different planet, right?
Right.
But there are lots of ways that you can change where you are. This is pretty easy with sprawling campaign settings that usually have regional source books. You know, like if you were on the Sword Coast and now, you know, if you want to play in Chult, it's going to be relatively easy to deal with like the, you know, even something like the Fall of Neverwinter or like, you know, demons in Icewind Dale. Like, who cares when you're right. in Chult? Even if there's like a new god in the pantheon, in an entirely different part of just the Forgotten Realms, you may not even care at all. You may not have even have worshippers of anyone like Tyr. So like, I don't care. In fact, Mol Haran has a totally different pantheon.
Yeah, it's like, how many worshippers are going to be there if you start it contemporaneously? You know, it's like, it's a problem for 100 years from now. Like, who cares?
Right.
It can also be helpful if you're using published adventures, right? Like, a lot of times they jump around to different areas too, so that they have a little bit of insulation, right? So you can follow some of that mold too. If you're following published adventures, look for things that are going to be, you know, slightly different. A lot of times they have little like callbacks or Easter eggs to other events that don't necessarily become dependencies either.
Right. If you've played this previous adventure, oh, don't worry, I have not.
Yeah, I assure you that I didn't. But Descent into Avernus is that way in like the current edition of D&D, right? Like it's kind of like a weird framing device of like, well, we can't just ignore the fact that a whole city fell into the nine hells. It got better, but like, you know, like it still caused a lot of ripples.
Yeah, this different focus can sometimes make the new game or like the new sessions so wildly removed that it functionally is a different setting. Like think about White Wolf, right? Like you can play a werewolf game or you could play a, you know, Vampire the Masquerade game, and they could both be in the same city and ne'er the two shall meet, you know?
Right. Even like a hunter game doesn't even scratch the surface of Vampire sometimes.
Right. you can change time periods, not just physical location. It's easier to do a prequel because then you don't need to deal with the repercussions of the events of the previous play, right? You avoid the whole butterfly effect thing. You just, you know, again, Star Wars does this all the time. Let's just do Knights of the Old Republic and we don't have to worry about canon at all.
Right.
Star Trek does this too.
You can also do a sequel, of course. That's harder because you have to make sure that you're somewhat insulated. But, you know, like Star Wars does sequels.
And you
they don't necessarily do them in order.
Yeah, the Filoni stuff is just jumping all around, right? You're sitting there for the first two episodes being like, when is this?
Right.
Or and like, I can't figure it out by the age of the actors because it's the same actors.
Right. The old EU stuff, right, was just like full of this where like, you know, there was continuity if one author wrote several books in a row, but God help us if they turned to a new author in the middle of it.
Right, who decided they didn't like the previous stuff.
Right.
Or, you know, didn't want to bother looking it up in the pre-Wikipedia days.
Right. Or, you know, didn't think it was cool that Han Solo abducted Leia and hit her with a mind ray to fall in love with him and get married. Weird.
Well, you know what? You know what? Someone's cooking here. I think they might have been right.
Courtship of Princess Leia, you say?
Right, yeah.
The other part of this and talking about changing time periods too that can kind of work is just resetting the canon, right? Just put things back the way they were. You know, not all changes last forever. Cultural inertia and just, you know, regular sort of entropy exist. Given enough time, you can just, hey, things reverted back to the way you know them, right? Those events happened, but functionally they didn't.
Yeah, there are a couple ways to go about this. Like, I think it can feel a little sitcom-y if like, doo-ly-doo, doo-ly-doo, everything's back the way that it was, or like those impactful moments that we had ended up not really changing anything, right? It's kind of like superhero media where you're like, great, Superman saved the world from, you know, Mongo's meteors, and now we're back to having to go to work every day.
I mean,
because he saved the status quo.
Exactly.
He didn't face capitalism because that requires rewriting. That breaks your setting.
Right. But like, also spell plague.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like, you didn't like that? Sorry. Oh,
yeah. Well, okay. We undid it. Mistral's name is Mistra now. Go have fun.
Right. Oh, yeah. There was a 100-year period where everything sucked. No one remembers anything about it. Those people are all dead. Yep. Yeah. Dead.
And that magic is definitely gone. Don't worry about it. Again.
Yeah. Yeah. Mistra fixed the weave. This is third Mistra. Same as the old Mistra.
Well, same as the old Mistra, but not the same as the original Mistral, because, you know, the big sacrifice for fixing the weave was losing an I and an L.
Well, you know, depends on exactly what does the way that things were mean to you.
Right.
And like this can be just a big deus ex machina, like the spell plague and rolling back the spell plague, right? Mm-hmm. Like it can be writers doing this. But you can, if it is interesting for your party, put the onus on the players, right? It can be, as we begin or as we continue to play, things are broken. Things are very different from canon. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that's a bad thing. But your challenge now is to put things back the way they were, as in fix, like this is probably easier if like a campaign ends poorly, right? With like the bad outcome. Mm-hmm. Like you failed. Okay, great. The system, the setting is broken in that I can't use my books anymore. But also the characters don't like that this happened. So let's fix it.
Unless, you know, second campaign is evil campaign.
Also true. Also now, true.
Let's go put the oppressors back.
Different goals and motivations. Different challenges.
Right.
And then, you know, there's the Dallas route, which is, it was all a dream.
Yeah.
Or at least some part of it was all a dream.
Right. Some pivotal moment was a dream. Or right, was, right. You know, in a suitably sci-fi setting, an alternate dimension or a hypothetical kind of like, you know, deep simulation or, you know, magic.
This sounds like a bad idea because, I mean, sort of like famously the Dallas episode where everything was just a dream has been, you know, sort of rightfully lampooned and ridiculed as like, a cop out and bad writing. But I think if you look at the way that we usually tell these stories, as you end a campaign, you know, there's the huge climax of the final probably battle, right? Mm-hmm. But then how do we figure out how do we tell the epilogue, the aftermath to each other? It's usually like a series of snippets or vignettes over the course of, I don't know, 10 or 15 minutes after like the last die roll, or like maybe there's like a short session afterward to sort of go through aftermath and see like, you know, who gets a good ending, who gets a bittersweet ending, et cetera, right?
Yeah.
But those, you don't spend nearly as much time on that section as you do on playing the bulk of the campaign. So that really is that little tail end can be rewritten or embellished or changed, right? Especially as like, if you have powerful characters, those epilogues tend to sort of be like mythic or legendary, or like, what did they do? Slayed a dragon single-handedly, but was like destroyed by fire, like Beowulf's death, right? Mm-hmm. But all of that is shrouded in legend. It could be that now you're, you know, sitting at the table, all of you not ending a campaign that you know you're going to walk away from, but knowing that now you are beginning something new or delving into something or establishing canon history, you can make changes or tweaks and say like, that was a legend, but here's what actually happened. Here's what we know to actually be true.
Right.
So it's not a dream necessarily, but there was an unreliable narrator.
Right.
It was me. I was drunk.
Yeah.
All of you were finishing a campaign of like 3 years. I was definitely drinking.
Another option is to firewall it off, right? Just contain the impacts to canon in whatever way you can justify. So, you know, the vast systemic change didn't take root as far as you thought, or, you know, the death of a beloved monarch or the sacrifice of a hero, right? Like, new entities rose in their place to more or less keep the status quo.
Yeah, they kind of did this with 4th edition Neverwinter, right? Like Neverwinter like collapsed or whatever and was like a ghost town after spell plague, I guess. And it's like, okay, there's all this canon like adventures and video games about like stuff happening in Neverwinter. And then this entire edition, just nothing happens there, right? Like, it's just a ghost or whatever. But
well, it was Neverwinter Night.
Well, yeah, and that was third edition, right? And then fourth edition comes along, and it's like, oh, Neverwinter doesn't matter.
No, it was like, it was nighttime in Neverwinter. There was just everyone was asleep.
Right, it was just still warm, mm-hmm. but dark. But they didn't really go through the work of like figuring out how the loss of a city that big, like a huge trading hub, would impact the rest of the Sword Coast. They just sort of said, Neverwinter doesn't really exist or do anything anymore. And everything kind of just worked around that. You know, they just trade mm-hmm. with Icewind Dale and Luskin now.
Right. But like no one addresses like the volume problem. Right. Or like,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like
where did the people go? Or, right. You know,
this huge loss of labor and market. And yeah. So I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3, and that is one of the things that like stood out. And I don't know if this was in the adventure or if this is just them like following up on it, but like it's set right after Descent into Avernus. And so like one of the early and fairly, I suppose, criticized kind of plot points is that like there are a lot of refugees from El Tauril around. Right. And they're trying to get to Baldur's Gate because that's like they're fleeing the city that has now fallen to the Nine Hells. Right. And so it's like the rest of the world is dealing with that in not the most subtle ways, of course, but like it's, you know, it's still D&D. But like that is that's an impact that I don't really recall ever being like very well represented across D&D settings, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, how is Baldur's Gate reacting to this huge refugee influx, right? Like, who is taking advantage of all of these like refugees that are suddenly like their world is turned upside down and their everything they own is on their back and they're desperate, you know? Like, surprise, surprise, a religious cult is involved, you know? It's like it feels very organic in a way that D&D settings so rarely do in other media.
Yeah, like they usually operate as like the different locations that you can play in usually operate almost as like city states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it like hardly matters what's happening right. in another city because like we're entirely self-contained and somehow self-sufficient.
Right.
Even though we have a merchant class, but you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Star Wars obviously does the same thing where, you know, each planet is a self-contained ecosystem, even though it only has one biome.
One biome, yeah.
Right. But like, you know, all the adventures that you have here don't necessarily need to affect anything off-world. And sometimes that means that the story is a little bit smaller in scope, but right. not necessarily. There's a lot of stories in Star Wars where like, you know, an entire world is destroyed and not necessarily blown up, but like, you know, still livable, but now garbage.
Right.
And like, does that disrupt trade in the Anoat sector? Not usually.
Right. Yeah. I mean, like 40K is classically this, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just uh-huh. like you might have a generations long war on one planet that like, you know, it's just a complete ecological devastation and economic devastation, like, you know, cost of billions of lives. And then it's like, oh yeah, like two systems over, like they don't even know this is happening. You know, it's
I mean, 40K is almost sort of like the quintessential version of firewall the effects, right? Like you can have an inquisitorial, like cyclonic torpedoes in one system, and in a different system, it's like meh.
Yeah. Also, like, yeah, the Inquisition is also very. Just single-handedly subverts entire things, and it's just like, oh yeah, so what? You know, planetary governor's dead, brand new ruling family, it's fine. The tides come on time.
And one good thing about 40K, and you know, if you're playing in that setting, is like, you know, you can wave your hand and say, oh, an Inquisitor did it.
Right.
Like, how did it happen? An Inquisitor did it. Why are there no repercussions? An Inquisitor fixed it.
Right. And also there's magic, so if you really need to, it's right. like, ah, yeah. Warp stuff.
Right. I mean, you know, why are we not affected by that here? There's a warp storm in between there and here. And so we have no idea what's going on over there.
Exactly.
Yep. You know, and in 150 years, maybe we'll find out. But for now, we're in a self-contained little ecosystem bubble right. and you can play your game.
Exactly.
We've mostly been talking about it in sort of a physical sense, but It can definitely happen maybe even more easily with something like politics, right? Where like literally, actually, the political upheaval only affects this one country because that's what politics is.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't change any other form of government. This coup that we enacted, every other country on the map is unchanged except that, you know, they're marshaling border forces, I suppose, or,
yep,
you know, cracking down on free speech. But other than that, like, you don't need to change any of the other monarchs. Now you're just dealing with one country that's different. And if you're a GM, now you make up one country, or if you're players, now you set up one government and that's it. You don't have to rewrite the entire world.
Right.
Natural disasters can also just affect like one continent or one shoreline or one country or whatever.
Well, I think we've learned that natural disasters have far-reaching global impacts, Ishan. That's been the common theme of the years 2021, 22, and 23.
I don't know what you're talking about. Tsunamis hit in one location, and earthquakes too,
and forest the atmosphere. Fires.
The atmosphere exists around one country.
It's true.
And it doesn't drift anywhere.
It respects sovereignty, okay?
That's right. The oceans can only absorb so much heat, and they've got plenty of leeway.
Well, just turn on the air conditioning. It'll be fine.
Right. Let's air condition the oceans.
Yeah. Keep the whales cool.
Right. In general, I think a good rule here is radically change only one area or aspect of the setting to make your life easier. And then you can roll out natural, like logical repercussions from there, but you probably only need to go like, you know, one or two sort of like spheres of influence out and you're basically done.
Yep. I think that's probably a good balance of like what's manageable from a scope of change to a what is rewarding for the players seeing their handiwork reflected later.
Yeah, because actually that makes it manageable enough that you can really feel ownership as a player over the changes.
You can have some unintended consequences there, and it doesn't feel like, oh, okay, so nothing worked. Great, thanks.
Right.
You know, like you can enforce enough of their intended change and intended consequence, like you can honor while also introducing complications that don't feel like, oh, okay, great. So every time we touch something, we make it worse. Why do we do this?
Why would we do anything?
Right. Which is kind of like, I think, the classic like punk setting problem, right? Mm. Of like, you can't really topple the system in a punk setting, right? Like, cyberpunk, like, you might topple one corporation, right? But like, you're not going to change the existence of, you know, like our corporate overlords. Like, but you also like, that means that you can take down an entire corporation and the setting still functions. You can still play punks. You don't then become the oppressor, right? Necessarily. But, you know, like, you've got to kind of like work around like, okay, well, maybe, you know, this company was responsible for this product or this like industry, right? Well, what does the world look like when suddenly like weapons manufacturing has gotten really mom and pop? Or, you know, what if now the corporations are at war over this new market you've created, you know, stuff like that.
What happens when Bechtel falls and there's no one to collect and sell rainwater to the people?
The people will collect their own rainwater. The people will collect their own rainwater.
But will they? Because no one has barrels.
We've got to get
anyway,
there. We've got a quarter of the market on
barrels.
It'll
be about 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly. Before it gets figured out by the corpse.
Right. And then, of course, there is, I don't know, the holy grail of dealing with these repercussions, the 9-to-5 job of dealing with these repercussions, which is just like, play it where it lies. You know, your players broke the setting. Great. The setting is different. You know, suck it up. Do the work. All of you, do the work of revamping that setting. Take ownership of it. You have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I think this is...
this is Morning Glory.
Yeah, but it's also like, it's one of those things where it's like, this is where it, like, this is where you probably end up if you use some of the other tricks in the same setting multiple times, right?
Mm-hmm. Eventually,
like, if you continue to kind of just like keep things slightly separate and like maybe just only the slightest fringe overlapping, like eventually you kind of get comfortable with like, okay, a lot of stuff is different. Like, we can start piecing this together, you know, like we could do that work. And now like we've gotten enough reward out of this that like, it's kind of worth it, you know? Then it feels like really rewarding and everybody's really on the same page, as opposed to like, oh, we found out the cause of the day of mourning. I guess let's do Eberron, but without the big question.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
oh, we fixed it, but that's the only thing that we changed. It's sort of the reverse of what we talked about earlier, is like, if the one thing that you change sort of like takes away the drama of the setting, then like, why are you even playing in that setting?
Yeah. Oh, we destroyed faster than light travel. Let's do Star Wars.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So there's no more hyperspace.
Yeah. Which was why I think like High Republic era is like less interesting to me. Cause I'm like, all right, we're not really dealing with Rise of Palpatine. Okay. There's no Galactic Empire. It isn't like heyday of the Jedi 3000 years ago. Like, what are we even doing here?
It's just deck chairs on the Titanic. It's like literally like, oh, I wonder if we can line these up nicely before it sinks. Like, it's, yeah, I agree. It's tourism. The answer is tourism. That's why you do that, right? Like, you want to be a tourist in that era, and that's fine.
I want to play with my lightsaber and not worry about it.
Right.
I mean, this can also happen. You can also get to this point really quickly if you were, for example, like Morning Glory, never intending for there to be a sequel or to want to play in the setting again. Mm-hmm. You know, with like, you know, continuing the same story, right? Like, when I was working on, you know, the ending to Morning Glory, and your characters were figuring out where you like wanted your destinies to go, it was what, 2015, right? And we certainly never expected that we would take the same characters and revisit the setting again. So we weren't thinking about the consequences of, you know, extinguishing the Silver Flame and bringing back Seer and all of those things that then needed to be dealt with later as we decided we would eventually continue it.
So we ended a detente of a global war. We destroyed a major religion that was also, you know, a theocracy. We brought a whole nation back. Oh, and we killed
which
a few
was the
overlords
only thing
in the process,
preventing the continuation of the nation, of the continent spanning war.
Right. Yeah. We brought a nation that was, as far as it knows, still at war back to an otherwise allegedly peaceful detente. What could ever go wrong?
Well, as we talked about a bit, recapping our latest Thrillicon weekend, we did sort of birthright it out to figure out what happened over the next year or so. But full disclosure, that is definitely still in process, and we haven't played out the repercussions yet. But I'll tell you right now, as the GM, I did not do all of that work. Everyone was both required but also interested in like doing it together, and also it probably helped that we took 8 years away from the story and then picked it up later.
Yeah, we forgot a lot of the details and grudges that would have made that
Which
a lot less
perfect.
Practical.
Yeah. So in this instance, right, most of the published info that you have is still actually going to be usable, right? Like, there's no game that changes every single thing in all your source books, because there's so much more information in your source books than you can possibly use in a single campaign or even multiple campaigns.
Right.
So, like, what is it? Let's just take Eberron for an example. Corvair has, what, 12 nations, 13 if you count Seer, and that's just on the one continent, and you've got, you know, 3.5 other continents. every single one, like it cannot be that every single one of those nations, every single one of those like noble families, lines of succession, like political intrigues, you know, four or five major religions featured prominently. So even if, for example, you're fighting against the quarry and you defeat the Dreaming Dark, you utterly obliterate the Dreaming Dark and you've solved the quarry and Kalashtar issue in your campaign. Great, that has repercussions, but there are still so many other things festering
right.
for you to deal with in tandem, in parallel, or afterward.
Well, and that's one of the things that makes it a good campaign setting too, right?
Right.
Like that's a hallmark of a good campaign setting is there's lots of places to play that are related, but not necessarily like too closely tied.
I mean, that was one of the problems with Dragonlance back in the day, which was it solved itself.
Yeah,
you know, like the story solved itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And Dark Sun kind of did the same thing, where it was like, oh, we're going to write some stories. We're gonna fix everything in the stories. Don't worry about it. I mean, you can still play. Your party's still important. They're gonna do things.
Do your own stuff.
Right. But everything else in those books can be cannibalized for this new campaign. And I say this both the GM and players, right? Like, so you know which major things, which major tent poles of the setting have changed. You sort of build out, you know, a few spheres of influence, like what are the ripples look like going out from there? But even if, for example, something is entirely displaced, like let's just say, you know, hypothetically, Cormyr is destroyed by a giant meteor, right? Maybe that was a spell-like thing. I don't know. But let's just take that for an example. That's fine. All the Cormyr information in your books is still usable. You just need to change the serial number. Mm-hmm. Right, like the noble families, their last names, their holdings, the amount of gold available in each of these towns, the magic items that are available, the names of the shops, the layout, the grid, all of that, still usable, probably can still use the same names. It's just not in Cormyr because Cormyr is a hole in the ground.
Right.
It's wherever else you need it to be.
Yep. And that's I think that's a very helpful thing to do is just to remember that like, stuff can always be mutable until it's fixed.
Mm-hmm. And then even then, you can always meteor it into the ground.
Exactly. So as you mentioned, right, like when we picked up Morning Glory, we kind of picked it up from like the day after. And I think that was a good choice because like we were closest to the origin of the ripple at that point, right? And so we were able to kind of follow it out in the different directions that it goes rather than, you know, if you start in a place in this quickly growing tired metaphor of like, you know, a few steps away, like you have to then kind of project out, okay, like what immediately changed? Okay, what was the after effect of that? Okay, what was the after effect of that then? And how does that impact where we're actually going to be now? Right. So, okay, so this nation fell, which meant that this family fell out of favor, which means that like, oh, this trade has slowed down and therefore like this region, which supplies iron to it, is now struck with a depression. Okay, so now instead of being in this profitable area, it's like, oh God, okay, right? It's like, yeah, well, or we could just be like right there as that family fell and like kind of work it out for there together. And like if we get out there, well, we will have dealt with those logical repercussions and that leap every single step of the way. So like we'll know that this area is economically depressed because of all of those reasons because we'll have seen it rather than projected it.
Yeah, playing out the ramifications of the previous sessions is good for at least two reasons. One is, you know, all of you are there at the same time making this communal decision in the way that you've been telling the story already, deciding what the future of the setting looks like. But also just like in terms of trying to get that information into your head, it really helps to be the one making the decision, right? It is less work than one person figuring all this out by themselves and then coming to the table and being like, okay, here's 100 years of fake history that you now need to memorize because your characters would know this information now that we're doing a sequel. But like, okay, but real me has been reading like dumb Drist books for 30 years. And like, I know Menzo Baranzen, right? Like not what you just made up.
Right.
Unless we, you know, toppled Menzo Baranzen and then like killed all the Mind Flayers. And then what did we do after that? Well, we figured it out together. And I remember that because we played it the same way that I remember all of the sessions that like we do together.
Yep.
Like one example I like to use here of like someone who did it well is Avatar, Last Airbender, right? The world fundamentally changed at the end of that first series. And then when Legend of Korra comes along later, it is functionally an entirely new setting, right? Advanced 70 years, like bending techniques that were rare 70 years prior now have practical applications. You have even more new types of bending techniques. There are like the political structure of each of the four nations has changed. But in order to do that, that required an entire writing team and a creative team and an art team to make an entirely new setting. And that's why it worked like that. Do not think that you can do this on your own or that even just your gaming group can do this on your own without like so much work.
That sounds dangerously like a caveat. Do we want to talk about some other caveats?
Well, you know, don't invalidate the success of previous campaigns and don't erase the failures either. I think this can be really difficult because a lot of things that we talked about kind of verge on doing that. So you need buy-in from your players about like, what is it that we're looking for from stories going forward? You know, do we want to just scrap this stuff and do really interesting things that don't, that aren't beholden to our previous stories? Then, you know, great, we're free, you know? But usually I think you want to preserve those stories or at least some aspect of them. So you need to work around them, which is, you know, basically what this entire episode has been about, is like, how do you work around them?
Right. And I think it's important that we aren't invalidating that as we do so, right? Like, we don't want to invalidate their success. We don't want to erase their failures. We want to like embrace what happened, but then move forward. You have to balance the like need for canon to be recognizable with the need for the player agency to be respected.
Mm-hmm. And I think when you're trying to sort of walk that tightrope, you need to be realistic about the amount of work that it's going to take and the amount of work that you can put into it, right? Like, this is a hobby for most of us, for the vast majority of us, mm-hmm. who are doing it on our own time, like after we have our regular jobs and are spending time with our families, right? So like, probably you shouldn't take on a task that it's going to take you years to do. Just dial it back. Dial it back, start small. You can always expand from there, but starting with, you know, trying to rewrite an entire setting is almost always going to be too much work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think an easy way, sort of a shortcut to do this is, you know, just expand the scope of your previous game or your previous sessions in order to minimize the relative impact of those previous actions. So it doesn't invalidate them. They still happened, right? But now you're just dealing with bigger stakes. And it was important that those previous actions happened, right? Because they acted as stepping stones to get you to where you are now. Their party saved the world. Great, you saved the world. Guess what? The world's safe. I don't need to do anything with the world now. The world's fine. Now we're playing in an interstellar game where there are lots of different worlds, or we've gone extra planar. You know, and you can serve as a shining example of like what can happen when there are heroes who are available and capable and can save the world. But there are a lot of worlds.
Well, do you hear that, Ishan?
I think that's the silence of empty space in between tiny jewels of solved worlds.
No. It just means it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge.
Ah, of course.
course. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane, at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne, that's Malice minus Meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes. All right. This week, we are building John Henry. Ishan, who is John Henry?
Well, this is kind of in our series of historical figures in that John Henry probably existed, but is an American folk hero.
So apocryphalia, I guess.
Yeah.
is he a folk hero or is he apocryphal? I guess he's a folk hero more than yeah.
From my cursory research, there probably was someone, or at least one someone, maybe multiple someones, who worked driving steel on the railroad, probably in the southeastern United States, who this story is based on. But really, the John Henry that we're focusing on here is the John Henry from the songs and the stories, who is...
And the cartoon, right?
And the cartoon, yes, exactly, right. Like a famous Disney one, I think, is probably the one most people know. For you non-Americans, John Henry worked on the railroad, basically helping to dig tunnels through mountains, and was, you know, tall and strong and wielded, famously, a 9-pound hammer, which he would swing relentlessly to drive into the rock. And he fought a duel against a steam-powered drill to see who could drill a tunnel the fastest. And he beat the drill in, you know, a blow for the working man. But he did so at the cost of his own life, worked so hard that he died, which has weirdly always made him a figure that is less threatening to white America because, you know, he like worked himself to death. And at the same time is also a figure who represents, you know, like perseverance in the face of impossible challenges. So I have always liked John Henry.
My memory of this is like very bad. I didn't realize the race was to dig a tunnel. I thought it was to like lay down the track.
The track was coming behind them. Although, are you thinking of Paul Bunyan,
maybe,
the cartoon?
It's possible.
Because there was also a steam locomotive. There was a steam locomotive in that one, the Disney version.
Yeah, I can't. I can't guarantee that I am or am not. I assure you, I don't know the answer to that question.
All right. So, the build is Berserker Barbarian 17, Champion Fighter 3. Now, the main things that we're looking for here are, one, wield a 9-pound hammer in two hands. Two, be very good at destroying rocks and walls and mountains.
Okay.
And three, be able to work so tirelessly and relentlessly that you die.
Okay. I see where we're going.
Yes. However, you don't have to, okay? You're just able to with this
build. You're able
to
work until you die, but you don't have to die. Got it.
That's right. You don't necessarily have to do that. Although I don't know, maybe it's like an interesting out for the character at the end of the campaign.
Oh, terrible. So
we're going human first. We're just being faithful to the song. That's what we're doing.
Okay.
Okay, so you're a human, and for your feet, you're going to take Great Weapon Master, which is going to massively increase your damage bonus. Because remember, the one of the main points of this entire build is hack through or pound through rock as quickly and as effectively as possible. And what does Great Weapon Master do? Well, it lets you take a -5 to your attack roll to do 10 extra damage. And is it a problem to take a minus five to your attack roll when you're attacking a static rock? Usually not.
Right.
Especially because Barbarian is going to give us reckless attack. So we swing with advantage and the rock doesn't swing back. So it doesn't matter that attacks also have advantage against us.
Right.
Your weapon of choice. There is no 9-pound hammer in this game, but the maul, 2d6 bludgeoning damage, does weigh 10 pounds, as does the sledgehammer tool. You can pick either one of those, wield it in two hands, because Greatwhip Weapon Master requires a heavy weapon to work. So that's what you're going to do.
Okay.
There's no bludgeoning D12 weapon, which I think is a shame. The math still works out better for a maul with 2d6 for the vast majority of the character's lifespan. But, you know, if you can convince someone to give you a D12 hammer later on, then I would go for it. It's not going to break anything. It's just, you know, is more interesting and cooler with the amount of critical dice that you're going to get.
Yep.
So Barbarian gives you a rage damage bonus. You will eventually get three additional brutal critical dice, which gives you one additional die on a critical. Now, because you have a maul, unfortunately, it's 2d6. It only adds 1d6 each time, but that's okay because as a fighter, you'll take the fighting style, great weapon fighting, which lets you reroll those ones and twos. And on a d6, you're much more likely to get a one or a two.
Yep.
But the main thing for Barbarian that we're here for is Frenzy, which lets you, during your rage, make an additional attack as a bonus action. And this is good because you are using a two-handed weapon, so it's the same big old massive damage die as your regular old attack. So you're attacking three times per round once you have extra attack. At the cost of gaining a level of exhaustion at the end of your rage.
Which, if you rage enough in the course of a day, you could stack it all the way.
It will kill you, yes. Eventually, you can rage enough to just die, or, you know, 2 days in a row or whatever.
Yep.
And you know what? You're pretty much exactly as effective at digging that tunnel with just you and a hammer up until you drop dead from exhaustion. Fighter also gets you action surge. So basically you're just taking a massive number of attacks and you get improved critical. This is important in like combat usually in that, you know, you'll crit much more often. You get a lot of brutal critical dice. So your crits are very large, especially with like the plus 10 and your rage bonus. Like you're looking at like, you know, mid 30s on crits later in the game, usually just like without even a magic weapon. And you're attacking, you know, a minimum of three times per round.
I suppose you'll also take proficiency in Mason's tools.
Yeah. Now, so this is the thing. What you in combat, you're a monster, right? You just smash things into the ground, and you know you're rerolling ones and twos on your damage dice. If you crit, which is going to happen pretty often, then you get an additional attack because of great weapon fighting. But if your goal is to deal as much damage as possible to walls and to rocks and to mountains, critting is the best way to do that because it's sort of up to your GM what the damage threshold is of that material. And that basically means you need to deal more than X amount of damage in order to deal any damage to the rock. Mm-hmm. So larger amounts of damage are always going to be better. That's why just a static, you know, plus 10, more like plus 13, plus 14 with your rage bonus, and then plus your strength modifier on top of that, like you're pretty easily going to have very high minimum damage. So it's very likely you're going to get over the damage threshold. Yep. What you really would like, though, and this shouldn't be a problem because it is not a magic item that you can't depend on, it is a regular bog standard piece of equipment that you can buy, is an adamantine maul. It costs you 500 gold, same as a silver weapon. And with it, you automatically crit every time you hit an object or a structure, which means that every time you swing your hammer and hit, which is pretty much every time, you crit, which then triggers Great Weapon Master. So you can as a bonus action, take another attack, which means that once you have an adamantine maul, you do not need to frenzy if you're attacking a wall. So if John Henry had had an adamantine maul, he would not have died.
I mean, if you give the working man better tools, he will be more productive.
Agree.
And safer.
Absolutely agree. Should also pay him because it costs 500 gold, right? So, like, you know, fair wages.
Yeah. You have to invest in your here workforce.
This,
all good
here on this Labor Day weekend that we were recording. Yes. Now, Mason's tools is an interesting thing because in Xanathar's, there are additional uses for tool proficiencies. And Mason's tools allow you to deal double damage to brick walls. So, is that a mountain? No. But you will, with an adamantine maul, you will automatically crit against a brick wall, which, you know, many buildings are made out of, and then you will double that damage if you are proficient in Mason's tools, because you know exactly where to hit it.
I like that. I thought that was there so that you could, like, build the tunnel and, like, you know, brace it as you're going through, but no, that makes sense. I like
you
that
can,
a lot.
You can certainly also do that. It is sort of an interesting side effect that, yes, you can, you know, dig through a mountainside faster than almost any other character with like without the aid of like high level magic, mm-hmm. but you're actually best at Kool-Aid manning through brick walls.
Of course you are.
One hit, no problem. Boom.
Great.
And there we are.
All right. That is John Henry. And before we wrap up, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
It is our 8th anniversary mailbag, episode 350. Get your questions in now.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building something silly, per usual, for these mailbags. It is Clifford, the big red dog.
Well, that's it for episode 349 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.